Solomon's life, and specifically Solomon's downfall, is the stuff that tragedies are made of. I think on par with any Shakespearean tragedy that you can read. One of the greatest kings of Israel falls out of favor with God because at the end of his life, he rejects God. The spiritual implications of this are enormous. The questions surrounding it are extremely perplexing. Not the least of which is, why would he do such a thing? Why would a man favored so much by God reject him in the end? What do we think about a man who didn't take his own advice to fear God before all else? How could a man of such wisdom become so foolish? He is testimony, perhaps on one level, that success in a worldly way does not always equal faithfulness. Perhaps the irony of it is that he seems to be even successful with God. God gave him more wisdom than God had given to anybody else before him. And yet at the end of his life, he turns away. It is interesting to compare at least David and Solomon, Solomon's father David, whereas in David we see a blatant failure at some point in his life, followed by a life of repentance and living with the guilt and sin. In faithfulness, I should add. And yet in Solomon we see a failure coming kind of late in his life and never seeming to come around to making the necessary change to kind of make himself right with God. It doesn't make sense. We want to kind of ask a couple of other questions about this incident, but we'll start first of all by simply noting what happens. Not all is well, apparently, in this house, of wealth and wisdom. You remember we talked over the last couple of weeks about wisdom and Solomon and how much God gave to him, and how when Solomon started his reign, when Solomon's in the beginning of his administration, one of the things he recognizes is, I don't know how to proceed here. He says, basically, I'm kind of a young guy here and I need a little bit of help. And so he turns to God and he specifically asks for wisdom. And God's very pleased with that because Solomon, in the position he's in, could have asked for most anything else. In fact, he ended up getting a lot of wealth and a lot of prestige and all the things that might normally accompany a position of that power. He doesn't ask for that. He asks for God to give him guidance. And that's what he gets, plus all the other things. Later on in his administration, God appears to him a second time, almost, it seems, by way of premonition of just something's happening here. And in that second appearing, God gives him a warning. And we read about it in 1 Kings chapter 9, verses 3 through 9. And the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your plea, which you have made before me. By the way, that's probably the prayer and the plea that he made at the dedication of the temple. I have consecrated this house that you have built by putting my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will be there for all time. And as for you, if you walk before me as David your father walked, with integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I have commanded you, and keeping my statutes and my rules, then I will establish a royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father, saying, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. But if you turn aside from following me, you and your children, and do not keep my commandments and my statutes that I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them, and the house that I have consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight, and Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all the peoples. And this house will become a house of ruins. Everyone passing by it will be astonished and will hiss, and they will say, why has the Lord done thus to this land and to this house? Then they will say, because they abandoned the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt and laid hold on other gods and worshiped them and served them. Therefore, the Lord has brought all this disaster on them." Solomon's wisdom had spread, and fame had spread far and wide. Later on in this text, in chapter 10 of 1 Kings, a queen from a land called Sheba finds it even more incredible than the stories she had heard. 1 Kings chapter 10, verses 6 and 7, she says to the king after having been there for a while, "The report was true that I heard in my own land of your words and of your wisdom, but I did not believe the reports until I came and my own eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity surpassed the report that I heard." Here is a man blessed by God beyond the imagination. Here is a man whose reputation, because of what God had done for him, had spread to other lands. Israel as a nation was a pretty small country, kind of right in the middle, right along a lot of the trade routes, and that could be how it was during this period of time that they were able to gain so much wealth economically. This was considered the golden age of Israel. And maybe even other ways, socially, and certainly by the amount of wisdom that came out of Solomon, we sort of have some sense of this was in fact a very golden age of revelation. By this time also, all the nations around Israel had been subdued by King David. There was peace. The temple was completed. The ark was put in place. Solomon became famous for his wisdom, and we see a comment also made in chapter 10, verses 23 through 25. "Thus King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. And the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear the wisdom which God had put into his mind. Every one of them brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, myrrh, spices, horses, and mules, so much year by year." And as the story goes on in chapter 10, Solomon even increased even more in his wealth and in his reputation. But then, he acts without any sense. And it's quite perplexing to look at this in 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 1 through 8. He begins to worship other gods. After all that God had done for him, after all the reputation that he had, thanks to God, thanks to the Lord, he rejects the very one who brought him there. Perhaps it's the classic statement, "He bit the hand that fed him." Completely rejects God. And he begins to worship gods of the nations around them apparently at the advice of his wives, or at the influence of his wives. It's three of them are mentioned: Ashtoreth, Milcom or Molech, same god probably, and Chemosh. Ashtoreth was known to be a goddess of fertility, love and war. The other two were often associated with child sacrifice. Whether Solomon actually did that may be another question. But these are the kind of things that he begins to worship. And he builds high places for them. When he knew for a fact that the temple that he had just built was for the Lord his God. But his wives influenced him to build other places to other gods. And we're still perplexed. Why did he do that? What possessed him to think that somehow this was the right thing to do? Interestingly enough, it's several hundred years later when we get to a person by the name of Josiah, and we'll get to him later on this year as we're kind of going through some of this. Josiah actually is the one who tears down these high places and restores worship at the temple. But that's kind of another story. But here's where those high places come from. And the text states simply that his many wives turned his heart away when he was old. Now, Solomon apparently married a lot of these wives, as was the habit of kings around them, as sort of political alliances with the surrounding nations. Sort of firming up, you know, well, your wife is in my court and we have an agreement about such and such. That's kind of an odd way of doing it, I guess, that we think, but that's the way they did it. They made these alliances this way. The problem was, Israel had been warned way back in the book of Deuteronomy about intermarrying with the nations around them. I'm sure Solomon knew that. You just want to stop and say, Solomon, what were you thinking? Here is the wisest man in Israel acting with utter foolishness at the influence of these individual wives. I don't know about you, but I want to ask the question, why? What made him turn away? You know, the simple answer is his wives made him turn they turned his heart away. Their influence was quite powerful. He had many of them. So their influence was perhaps magnified with each one. But I think we still have to kind of ask the question of ourselves. What makes anyone turn away from God? Well, there are a number of reasons that I think we can come up with, and maybe some are sufficient. Maybe these are things that cause some of us to turn away from God. How about money, wealth, prestige and fame, power? Now, what's interesting to me about these is Solomon himself had more of this than anyone else. It didn't seem that the power and wealth sort of made him be unfaithful, however. In fact, if you look in the book of Ecclesiastes that we looked at recently, apparently, when he looked at all those things that he had, all the wealth and the power and the fame and the building projects and the things that he was able to amass, what's the refrain he keeps coming back with? Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. All is vanity. He looks at all that wealth and he says, it really didn't bring meaning into my life. He looks at all those building projects and he said, those didn't really bring meaning into my life. He looks at all the accumulation of pleasurable things that he had. He even says at some point, I denied myself nothing. But when I looked at him, I said, they were all meaningless. They really didn't bring me the satisfaction that I thought they would bring me. In fact, in that book, Solomon comes to the conclusion that there's only one thing that's really necessary and important for man to do, and that is to obey and worship God. That's the conclusion that Solomon himself comes to. So at least in his case, it doesn't seem that the wealth and the power and the prestige and the fame were the things that turned his heart away. They are, however, sometimes the things that turn our hearts away, aren't they? Isn't it interesting some of the questions that Jesus asks us of our lives? He asks us to think about. I always love the question, and it's a great rhetorical question. It's a great thought to keep in mind, and Jesus never really gives an answer because he assumes the answer. What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world but loses his soul? Can we give it sort of a contemporary thought? What does it profit a man if he wins the Super Bowl but loses his soul? I like sports. I'll probably watch the Super Bowl tonight. But what does it profit if I win that and I still lose my soul? It's kind of interesting to me. A couple years ago, Terry Bradshaw, I don't think he had any kind of conversion experience, but he did make the comment that even after having won 4 Super Bowls in his career, he still suffered with depression. It didn't give him enough meaning in his life to overcome the depression that he was struggling with. 4 Super Bowls. And Tom Brady may win more than that. But it really just doesn't satisfy. And so, you know, we have to be careful of placing our meaning in those things and what we do in our lives. Well, it could be that keeps us from being faithful or causes us to turn away at some point. How about the issue of sexual immorality? Does that sometimes keep us from God? Well, sure it does for some people. Solomon had many wives, it says. Dare we say this particular thing was his downfall? I think we could probably say it certainly seemed to be his wives, but I think it goes deeper than just the sexual immorality part. Surely out of his many wives, there may have been at least a few who would have supported his refusal to worship other gods. Surely there was a couple of them in that 700 or so that he had. Surely he had some wives that he had married from the Israelite nation who would have said, yeah, this is what we need to do. Maybe they even said, don't do that. So it kind of goes deeper than that, doesn't it? Ephesians chapter 4, verses 18 through 24, Paul makes some interesting comments in there about what happens to our hearts when we begin to allow those things to predominate. When we begin to allow our desires for things and for immorality to predominate in our lives. Here's what he says. In speaking to, well, let's start in verse 17 where he says, "Now this I say and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds. They are darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to," and here's the phrase I want you to think about, "hardness of their hearts. They have become callous and they have given themselves up to sensuality, greedy to practice every kind of impurity." Something about the practice of those things does something to our souls. It does something to our hearts. Paul will talk later on about the corruption through deceitful desires in verse 22. And somehow it's that corruption and that hardness of heart that really keeps us from turning. Somewhere along the line, we just can't see. You know, our hearts get so hard that nothing penetrates. And it's from focusing on all of those desires and wants and deceitful things that create a kind of hardness over the years. You see, without some watchfulness, without some insight, without some understanding that the gospel brings, our desires of the flesh kind of do the same thing to us. They just slowly but surely make us hard. And then we end up not being able to see. And we end up perhaps rejecting the faith that we would have known, should have known better, not to reject. So does sexual immorality keep us from God? Yes. Can it turn us from God? Sure. There's a third and final thing, however, that we should perhaps ask about. You know, does perhaps suffering and pain destroy our faithfulness? Does that perhaps turn us away from following God? Again, I would turn back to Solomon and listen to the book of Ecclesiastes. It's interesting in there that one of the things that Solomon recognizes in there is that tragedy occurs in people's lives. In fact, if you go through and listen to what Solomon is saying, he says at one point, it's kind of even better for us to be in the house of mourning than in the house of mirth. There's something about that smacks of reality to Solomon. And he says there's something about that we learn about our lives, I guess, that really makes, kind of gives us a certain amount of sense of let's keep our bearings straight here and what our lives are all about. But he also recognizes that injustices occur. Things that don't make sense. Things that are unfair. And I'm sure you've all heard the expression, well, life is unfair. You know, get used to it. Well, in a way, yeah, there's a truth to that. It isn't always fair. And yet I would suggest that Solomon still manages to cling at the end of the book to the notion that, you know, the whole duty of man is to serve and worship God. He doesn't have the hope that the gospel brings that we have, but he still can at least come to that sense of let's not reject God with all of this injustice and tragedy and pain. I tend to think that for some of us, anger over past hurts and injustices are one of the biggest means that Satan can use to destroy our faith. James chapter 5, verses 9 through 11 addresses the problem. Apparently he sees it in his own day. It's not new, not unusual. James says, "Do not grumble against one another, brothers." And you can only imagine what were the causes of the grumbling against one another. Could have been a number of things. He says, "So that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. You kind of wonder why he doesn't throw in there, and you've seen the lack of steadfastness in Solomon, who wasn't steadfast to the end of his life. It is a tragedy, isn't it? When anyone leaves God, when anyone leaves God behind, when anyone rejects God, but it seems especially so when someone who had so much promise, who fulfilled so much of what God wanted him to do, who ruled his people with wisdom that God had given him, who had been given all these blessings by God, and yet at the end of his life, tragically, perplexingly, he turns away. I kind of don't get it. Well, in a way I do, because I see it. It does happen to us. I see the temptations to turn away. We'll go back to a question that I kind of asked at the beginning, at least in my own mind. Can a wise man become a fool? Apparently. Can a person of faith lose his faith? Apparently. I suspect that each one of us kind of has to keep a close eye on our own heart. Maybe we don't need to leave out also our need for other people to help us in our struggles against faithlessness. Be careful of allowing your feet to slip. Remember the parable of the sower. Matthew 13, verses 1 through 9 and 18 through 23. Jesus even goes to the point of explaining the parable for us. And he talks about there being four types of seed or four types of soil. And those four types of soil essentially represent four types of human hearts. Farmer sows the path along the sows seed along the path, and the path is hard. The seed cannot penetrate, and the birds of the air come and they eat up what's there. When a farmer sows the seed along soil that has a lot of rocks, well, the seed gets a little bit of root, it springs up quickly, but then when suffering and persecution occur, it simply dies out and cannot endure. Then, of course, there is seed that's sown among thorns. And Jesus says, the cares of the world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the world, or choke the word, and it proves unfruitful. And all the things about life that sort of get in the way of the seed growing in our hearts. And then, of course, there is the last, and that is the fruitful soil. The soil where the seed penetrates, gets lots of root and nourishment, is not choked out by weeds and other things, and produces a crop. Which type of soil are you? Or perhaps I think a better question is, which type of soil are you determined to be? Because we have a choice. And we sometimes have to look at the things in our lives and simply reject one thing to have something else. And that something else is the most precious thing we can have. It is the kingdom of God. Solomon had it, but he let it slip away. Don't let that happen in your life.